Hello and welcome. I'm Elizabeth Turk, a counsellor, trainer and writer.
And I'm Paul Gaunt, a careers advisor, trainer and lecturer. And this is How We Care.
Conversations about what it takes to help people for a living.
We are two experienced and committed helping professionals who are passionate about finding the best ways to take care of the people we help through our work and to support helping professionals to take care of themselves.
So if you're a counsellor, careers advisor, coach, social worker, medical professional, a learning and development or HR professional, or any other skilled helper or aspire to be one, this podcast is for you. Let's reflect on how we care. Hello and welcome to episode 20 of How We Care. That's exciting. So today we've got a special guest episode and our topic is supporting students and your own well-being in educational settings. So I'm really excited to get onto this topic because lots of our topics are really relevant to teachers, lecturers, academics, but we haven't really kind of had any interaction with anyone who actually works in that field before. So I'm very excited today to tell you about our guest, Dave Wood, PhD. Dave is a very old friend of mine. Not that he's very old, but we've been friends for a long time, and I'll get onto that in a minute. But just to introduce Dave to you, he's multi-talented. He's an artist, a researcher, a teacher, an author, and course leader at Dundee University. So he has many, many strings to his bow, and over the conversation I'm sure we'll talk about the evolution of his career. So Dave, do you want to tell us a little bit about your career?
Yes, so as Elizabeth says, I've known you since about 94, I think it was, when we first met. I was originally an illustrator, then moved through that into publishing, into design, from design into interaction design, out the other end of instruction design into lecturing, and I've been a lecturer since the day after 9/11 happened.
Wow.
And so I've been a lecturer ever since then. So that was like, what, 2001?
Oh, okay.
2002, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've kind of gone up through the ranks in your academic career as well.
Yeah, lifelong learning and all that. So, from being an illustrator, I've been every type of student possible, from being like just a young student through being mature students through all the different levels of academia up to where I currently am now, which, as you said, I've reached as far as I can go in regard to education. Mm-hmm. But I'm learning every day. And learning from the students as well in regard to the topic we're going to be discussing today, which is mental health.
Yeah. Do you know what, though? All of this already, this is how this podcast works. Everything sparks more and more and more ideas. So already you've got me thinking about how much your own experiences as a student will be useful to you supporting students. I mean, it might sound obvious, but that hadn't kind of come up for me yet. So now you've been talking about that. Obviously, you have that fantastic insight, which is kind of used to exist in industry and business, didn't it? Where people would work their way right up through. That doesn't happen anymore as much. But in your career, you have experienced, as you say, all the levels of education. Therefore, when you are working with students, you know what it feels like to be in each of those levels and some of the things that can come up for people.
Yeah, I think empathy has a lot to do with this, that by the very nature of experience, you or myself, I'll speak obviously for myself rather than for everybody, but I think the level of empathy of remembering back to what I would have needed at that particular phase. And I know that's only an individual thing, but you know, it's that thing that I'll give you a quick little anecdote about where this has sort of materialized from. That recently during the first lockdown, when we were all online, I organized afternoon talks every second Thursday with industry people for my students, IT to graphic design. And I had a couple of really big industry people who'd set up their own design studios, given the benefits of their experience. And one of the very first questions in the Q&A afterwards, didn't put the camera on, but came on with the voice, and said, "How do you handle imposter syndrome?"
Oh, okay. We've got a whole episode on that.
Oh, yes. Nice segue there. And they were absolutely shocked, the students, is, when both of these big industry people went, every day.
Wow, that's so great.
It became like Spartacus. Like, once one said it, the next person went, "Yep, I've got it." And even myself came up, obviously on camera. "Yep, I've got
it."
Every
single day. That's amazing.
And it's one of those things that it was a domino effect that all of a sudden the students realized individually, the lockdown in their own flat.
Yeah.
That they collectively were all suffering from exactly the same thing that everybody suffers every single day.
Yeah, thinking it was just them.
Absolutely. And I think that was a big valuable lesson of where things had actually got to. Because obviously it was a very stressful time for everybody.
Yeah, horrendous.
But for the students starting their education at undergraduate level.
Yeah.
In their own flat, never actually meeting anybody else. All these things going through their heads.
Yeah, no chance to chat like you would normally do in a normal setting.
Absolutely. Wow. So I've used that story ever since 2020.
That's a wonderful story. So now that everybody benefits from that revelation, that's really great.
And I think it's that openness, the fact that being honest, that you're not trying to hide stuff from everybody by people thinking, if you say this, you're going to look weak.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the biggest fears that we have to overcome. And I think that's something as a student, you definitely don't get taught.
Yes.
It emerges through your exposure, and it should do because I try to be a different lecturer to the type of lecturers I had back in the 80s.
Because
there was a whole different educational system then, and the nurturing aspect, I suppose paternally, I joke with them that they're my babies, as they go grow through up to the point of graduation, and then they fly the nest.
But there is a lot of that, isn't there? I mean, it's the same in the work that I do. It's like there is a lot of parental type of supporting and nurturing, and as you say, with the goal of people flying off on their own. And you're kind of, but you're also, what's coming up for me now, multiple things, is you're also modeling. That, I mean, I think that might be something we talk about a lot. You are modeling being open, honest, and vulnerable about all manner of different things. And it also makes me think a lot about just how hard it is for students to do that in a setting where they're being assessed. I mean, it came up like really ironically in the training I did. I'm literally supposed to be training to help people with their mental health. But we still had the same problem in that if we were going through anything emotionally difficult, we were still like, well, if I say this, is it going to jeopardize my career? Is it going, not this wasn't coming from the staff or anything like that, but it's a real dilemma, isn't
monologue.
It it's like, is it okay, they're telling me I need to be self-aware and all this, but is it actually okay to admit vulnerability here, because at the end of the day I'm getting marked for this and I've got to impress and I've got to be good. So it's that eternal dilemma, isn't it, for students, especially new students like you're saying, undergraduates.
Yeah, they're learning to be students and they're learning to be professionals. And there's a lot of stress. And, it's a different ballgame now to when I was a student in the 80s. I was one of the last years who got a grant for a start.
That's huge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, students have sometimes pulled into jobs and trying to balance the life and study and all these other, trials and tribulations that come with being young and discovering the world for the first time, away from the parental home. And all of this stuff they are going through for the very first time.
Yeah.
And it was an external examiner for the illustration course just this year who, at the end of the assessment board, the exam board, just reminded everybody around the room, because we've been, doing this for a long time, all of us, And every year we get new undergraduates come in. But he said, just remember, it's not our first time. It's their first time every year. And it's yeah. We need to be reminded of that.
The fresh, yeah, the attitude of freshness and the awareness of the newness. But that also, that intersects with, I'm sure you do this, but I don't know if you've ever thought of it like this, the approach to the work, which is all about curiosity, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's about, it's about sometimes if, in what I'm doing, if I'm feeling a little bit stuck or unsure about something, immediately returning to curiosity is a reset. Yeah. And it's, you know, like literally going back to, well, it doesn't matter that I don't know. All I have to do is find out. You know, so it's that attitude of curiosity that you're also taking to each individual newness student. Whereas with me, I guess it doesn't have to be a new client. It could be someone I've worked with for 4 years or something. But the issue is the newness, isn't it? It's like, well, I don't know what's going on here, but it doesn't matter because we can find out. That's the work, isn't it?
Well, the other thing about this is, as you just mentioned, you know, somebody you've been working with 4 years, 8 years, a lifetime. You're always going to discover something new about each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because every day is a new day and a new set of trials and tribulations. And behind the scenes, in whether you're staff or whether you're students, every day you don't know what they're facing for that day.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's that humanity, I suppose.
And keeping that openness and not falling into the trap that a lot of people tend to fall into over a career, which is to start making lots of assumptions about things, because it's the opposite of making an assumption that you've just described, isn't it? It's like, like you say, every day is different. Everybody's life is different as each day comes. Mm-hmm. So keeping that openness is wonderful and exciting. And it's also really, really good for people getting older as we are, you know, like coming like in the middle to late stages of our career, to keep that attitude to life. It keeps us like really vibrant and alert, doesn't it? Because I think as I was thinking about doing this with you today, I was also thinking about how much that is part of who you are. You're always learning, you know, for yourself as well as for work. Yeah. You know, you're very curious. You're always wanting to learn. You're always looking at things and developing yourself, aren't you?
Well, I think, you know, as I say, we're post-COVID. We've come out of that period. And I got criticised back over East there by somebody for referring to it as pre-COVID, post-COVID. I was like, oh, you're still talking like that? I was like, well, it was a monumental moment in history that we were pre-COVID doing stuff, and then now we're doing stuff post-COVID. Mm-hmm. And it is a natural, you know, moment in life to know that you've reset yourself.
Yeah, and to also acknowledge the impacts, because that it also comes into what we're talking about, doesn't it? That there is lasting impacts. I mean, I don't know how much you sort of see that in the people you're working with, because I guess some of them have now finished and graduated and kind of moved forward. But like, I think this is something that I'm noticing, kind of slightly off topic, but it is important, is that a lot of people are not wanting to engage, like that person you were talking to. Don't want to think about COVID. Oh, no, we're going to pretend that never happened, even though it's actually still happening, by the way. But anyway, people don't want to talk about it. And so in not doing that, there's a denial of the lasting impacts, whether they're physical health stuff, like long COVID, or whether they're mental health, or whether they're loneliness, or whether they're changes in family or grief. Pretending that's not happening or not hasn't happened is really, really bad for people.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, that I mean, the year I've just graduated was the COVID year. As one of my students at the graduation said, oh, we're your COVID babies, because I've been referred to them as my babies. Like, oh, we're your COVID babies. Like, why didn't I think of that for the last 3 years? But you know, they started completely on screen, never met them for the first year of their education.
So difficult.
You know, physically met them.
And
now they graduate and, you know,
what an achievement. That's like even more of an achievement than it would be, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's that period of time where around the country, that graduating year was that COVID year. Mm. And, you know, an external examiner as well. So I see other universities and their years and things like that, and other colleagues in other universities. And, you know, it is that thing that it has impacted on them.
Yeah. But
the negative to flip it to the positive, which is what I try to do with all the years graduating, is what they had to do in their learning helped, you know, the way for them to frame this. Just think that the very people that they're hoping to get a job with now had to learn how to design professionally at the same time online. So they've now got the skill sets to be able to design remotely, to talk remotely.
So they're way ahead of the game for people who finished before them.
That's the way to, you know, I mean, trying to get them to frame what was a negative thing to a positive thing, because I know, I mean, you just mentioned about all the different career paths that I've taken, also like interconnected, but, you know, completely disparate career paths, that the resilience I had when I first met you, when I was an illustrator, I had a freelance illustrator setting up Network 3 in Liverpool and all these other things. I did that because I was trying to kickstart a career.
Yeah.
But little did I know that all this stuff that was not paying me anything to do, but it was something that I had to do to try and get paid for something eventually.
Yeah, to move yourself forward.
Now flipped itself that I'm drawing on all of those things that I did voluntarily.
Yeah.
Now as a lecturer. And I was like, oh my God, it was worth all those volunteering things. Because it's not just the lived experience that I draw on, but it's those little moments of fear that I had to overcome to do the next thing without knowing what benefit it's actually going to do for me.
Yeah.
And at the time, it didn't feel like it was a benefit, but later in life, it becomes a benefit. And I become that crusty old like stage to the students, because obviously I'm now at the age, I've gone through the age of being like their parents' age, and now I'm creeping into the grandparents.
Oh no, that's just so hard to get your
I'm happy with that. I just became a great uncle this this year, so I'm happy with that transition in life. But it's that thing of, as I say to them, the old joke, that the old lecturer's joke, that we're like the design parents. They don't listen to us, but as soon as somebody from industry comes in, they're the cool aunties and uncles. They listen to exactly the same thing we've been saying for the last 10 weeks.
It's like, oh, what a good idea.
In one idea. So, you know, I play on that all the time. You know, these analogies to family and things like that. They never listen to us because they see us every single day, you know, and all these other things. But it is that thing that I try to think about, what would I like to have known or be reassured of?
What would you say to your younger self?
That type of thing. But it's like, what reassurance would I have needed when I was trying to do this back then?
Yeah.
To know that it may not work immediately, but
you'll be
10
okay.
Years down the line, you don't know how much it's actually going to benefit you.
And you will make an amazing career that you might not have even thought of that would be really fulfilling. I mean, that's, you know, you obviously love everything that you do. I mean, it's interesting that you've mentioned Network 3 there, because I was going to bring in this at some point. Because when we do this podcast, we don't prepare it. But what happens, like, this is another strand I'll come back to. It's actually quite a creative process, even though we don't plan it, so we don't write anything. We have a title, we have a person to talk to, and then we go about our day-to-day lives. And like with any creativity, ideas will pop into your head.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other day I was wandering around and it suddenly hit me that the reason I met you was literally because, I mean, I don't know if you see it like this, but it was because you took a not parental, but I'd say more of a mentoring role to my ex-partner, because I met you with my ex-partner.
Yeah, like, I remember the day.
I remember it. And because he's younger than you, he was new to Liverpool, he didn't really know anybody, didn't know anybody, did he? So, and you took this really lovely, supportive role with him. And I remember, I mean, it's not that I hadn't forgotten that, but I was thinking about how that is kind of how you've always been. Even when you maybe weren't thinking about it in the way you do now, you took that role, and it was so lovely. And obviously, we're still friends independently, now. And it was, you know, that's a big part of you, which maybe I didn't realise at the time, because I was like, I don't know, I just finished university at the time, so I wasn't aware of any of this stuff that I am now. But that's always been a part of you, hasn't it?
Well, it's funny that you cite that as obviously that moment when we met, because I still remember it was in Cribbins when
yeah,
we had
it
that
was. Yeah,
top floor as a gallery space.
Yeah.
And I think Mark got in touch with me, and then I said, we'll come along. And then both of you turned up, and then we did a portfolio review there and then.
Yeah.
While we was invigilating and stuff. And you won't know this, you won't realize this. Okay. You were there at the very beginning, because that was the moment when I had somebody who wanted nurturing in a way that I needed.
Right. Okay.
Uh-huh. So it's that,
wow.
You know, in a way, it was a bit of projection that, in a way, that was the moment. I thought I had an idea behind me that I think I might enjoy lecturing, but I'd never had a chance up to that point, because I was still fairly fresh myself. But I think I always remember that moment as well, because it was sort of the trajectory that I didn't realize I was on to where I am now, because it was that moment where, as I was talking through Mark's portfolio with him, and you were watching, you were chatting to the other people in the gallery and stuff like that, things were starting to fall into place, you know, in a very embryonic way.
Right, okay.
With myself.
Wow.
Going, actually, I wish I had somebody tell me this.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's not amazing. That's really moving. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Because it was so important for him. I mean, he would say the same. You know, in fact, I'm seeing him this week. I will be telling him about this. I mean, you know, but that it was so important for him, because as somebody who's like new to a city and didn't know, well, he was new in it, his career was very early stage as well, so he didn't know anything about what he was supposed to be doing. So to come into that space, I mean, I loved it. I'll come on to why I loved it so much. Because I wasn't an artist by any means at that point, but that's another bit. So for me to be in that space and see all the people working and all the, you know, I've made some other good friends in that space, didn't I?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like there was all this activity and excitement and creativity going on. But, you know, he could have walked into that space and just gone, yeah, that's all right. But you were there and you were like really supporting him. And, you know, and from then he made a really good career also. That was a pivotal moment.
I mean, that was about 94, because we set up 93. We started Network 3 in 93. There were three of us. That's why it's called 3. And so Quiggins was about 94, 95, something like that. Mark was like about 2 years behind where I was.
Yeah.
You know, in career development sites away. But also, you know, since the nature of the podcast, you know, I'm quite open about this, that... I was only myself sort of 2 years out of recovering from deep depression. And it's those things, that the activities that I got involved in with Network 3 and things like that, was my way of being proactively trying to start a life, not restart it, because I hadn't had a life yet.
I had a life.
So it was that thing of, it was something that, you know, I went through CBT I can't remember how many years after that. Can't remember. I might have been going through it, or might have been after it, around about the same time. It was a blur that period of time. So I just sort of probably gone through the CBT classes and things like that. And the leader of the CBT thing, I don't know what the official job title was, used a term that stayed with me, which is the wounded healer.
Ah, yes, very important term. Yeah,
and I think that has stuck with me. And when, you know, I talk to students about, you know, their mental health issues and their moments of being unsure whether or not they have got depression at the time, or they're just having a down period.
Yeah.
But it's that thing of within the creative industries, it's probably more prevalent with us to go through depressive episodes because of the very nature of creativity.
Yeah.
You know, some have, you know, deeper depressions than others. You know, I'm not the expert on that side of things. I'm a doctor, but I'm not that type of doctor. but it's that elements of, yeah, I think students now got a lot of things on their shoulders, and we are better at talking about this. So obviously,
yes.
Is it a case of students have got more on their shoulders that there's more mental health episodes happening, or is it because
we know them about it more?
We know about it more, and I'm now in my career as the elder statesman of the team that I'm learning every day. Every time I talk to a student who's going through a bad time, I just remember back to where we were in the 80s, because I didn't self-diagnose myself until 91, I think.
Yeah.
And I still remember the time I was on a bus, and I knew this is more than just not being able to get any work. This is something underlying it.
Not right. Yeah.
And a rainy day in Liverpool, winter, looking at my reflection on the, you know, the raindrop window that was misted up and that. Mm-hmm. And I just saw my reflection and I looked dead, you know, my eyes looked dead.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. And I was like, I think I've got depression. And of course, at that time, we didn't know really what that meant.
Yeah, there was nowhere to find out. Whereas now it's so easy. Sometimes it's too easy and it's too much information, but it's much easier if there's something not right to kind of research it and find out.
Because
then it's interesting as well, because I didn't know anything about your mental health stuff until much, much later, but partly because of how we met, you know, because of that different dynamic. But, you know, it's just not something, it's not something now that people who are like new friends or kind of not that close friends would talk about. But I think now, because everything's changed, people do talk so much more. And, you know, particularly men. I mean, it's good to have a man on here talking about this, because my experience of working with men in therapy has gone from 5% to 40% caseload. Yeah. It's absolutely fantastic. I love it. It's really, really good. It, you know, there's a lot more, you know, it's becoming a lot more acceptable, isn't it, to talk about difficulty and things
absolutely.
Like that.
You know, I've got, you know, other friends, you know, friendship circles outside, you know, like the teaching, things like that. And the men within those circles are more apt now, you know, roughly around about my age, you know, older, slightly younger, but, you know, around over 50. Over 50. That the conversation is now a completely different conversation about mental health than it would have been 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even 10 years ago. It's rapidly changing, and, you know, in a good way. But coming back to what you said about, is it that there's more of it or is it that it's different? I think it is a bit of, but I think a lot of, especially for students, I think, as you pointed out earlier, there isn't any, you know, you don't get grants anymore. You have to, there's so much debt, there's so much. And I think another thing for creative people that contributes to mental health issues is the uncertainty of creative careers. I feel like I want to mention that, because so many of my friends are artists, and you know, and so there's a lot of kind of instability in a lot of artistic career trajectories, and like not knowing if you're going to be earning a living. You know, all of that isn't great, is it, for people's mental health?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that, you know, I've taught illustration. I'm currently, you know, running graphic design. And, you know, for people out there who have no idea what the hell I'm talking about in regards to these two terms, they are creative industries. They're both communication design, but they both have different career structures. Mm-hmm. Graphic design, you know, easier for a studio job to be taken.
Yeah, yeah.
But for illustration, it's mostly sole trader, freelance.
Yeah, self-employment. Whatever. Yeah, yeah. Very
and that
different.
Was my trajectory. So, you know, one of my colleagues set up, you know, a design business, you know, fairly youngish and being successful in regards to having a design studio, employing people and things like that. Mm-hmm. But my career path has always been freelance, never knowing where the next job's coming from, the next paycheck and all these other things. And I've noticed that with the different teachers teams I've worked with over my career, that I come at things, and I suppose the word now is entrepreneurial. I would describe it more as seat of the pants.
Yeah, because that's what it can feel like. Like this, this what we're doing right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a good example?
You know, and I'm sort of, when COVID hit, I know I keep harking back to that. But when COVID hit, it was because I'd been a freelance illustrator throughout the 90s. And, you know, there was a period of time, thankfully working time, when I hadn't seen daylight because I was working through the night, sleeping during the day, working through the night, sleeping during the day.
Wow, so you were prepared.
And I was feeling, you know, back in the 90s, like vitamin D deficiency, because it was like, what's that thing up in the sky that we don't see often anyway? You know, I'm sure I'm supposed to be getting more of that sort of light, you know. Yeah. But when it came to COVID, it was like, okay, I know I can do this. I know I can survive this. I can get through this. And I sort of like went back into, I suppose, mental muscle memory.
Yeah, and so you used all those skills. Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about supporting students' mental health. You give some really great examples about the way that's been done in group settings and things like that. And I'm guessing sometimes on a one-to-one, it can be a very different thing. But without actually giving, you know, specific examples, I'm also interested in, this podcast is really heavy on practitioner well-being.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we're talking a lot about your ability and skills and resilience and the way that's all helped your work and supported your students. I also want to think a little bit about how you look after yourself in that, or if there's any times where it, you know, can be a bit tricky and challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a trained professional, and as I mentioned earlier, it's more about an empathic approach. And you know, I've got friends other than yourself, like, who have been counselors, trained as counselors. And so, you know, just hearing how the training of counsellors, the human-centred approach to counselling, I can identify with that from a design perspective.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's that humanity, that shared humanity, which I think we all have to keep reminding ourselves of, that, you know, we aren't in my area of the creative industries doing it for yourself. And we are always got an audience, and I'm big on people, the students, realizing that. And I try and disabuse them in the nicest possible immediate way when they start, that you're not designing for yourselves. But as a practitioner, you can't separate yourself from your work.
Yeah.
And I think that is a development that students need to engage with consciously as much as they can. The fact that when they get critiqued on their work, it's not about them. Mm. It's about the ability to communicate to somebody else.
Also, there's so many elements that need to be thought about separately here, isn't there?
And I think the mental health aspect of supporting students going through elements of that at different times in their career paths, while they're with me, it's all interconnected, because as they grow as students, I haven't got the hair for this anymore, but I'm going to start sounding a bit hippie-ish, that the it is about the fact that they have to be mindful of, this isn't defining them as a person. So if they get critiqued and it's not successful, it's it has no bearing on who they are themselves.
Right.
And I think that's a valuable life lesson we all have to learn. And some of us had to learn it harder ways. And I purposely try to prevent that type of teaching.
Yeah, happening. You don't want to be adding to the critical kind of, yeah.
And I suppose throughout my career, I've been every type of lecturer possible, because earlier days, learning to become a lecturer and feeling, you know, that imposter syndrome, that, you know, how am I doing this? You know, I'm only like one page ahead of them, you know, at times. So that's the way I felt like, you know, with my knowledge to where they needed and things like that, that I was conscious in the early days. I'm talking about, you know, early 2000s or something like that, when, you know, as I became a lecturer in 2001, I think it was. So we're talking about early 2000s, mid 2000s, something like that, where if I went out on a limb to support a student who was going through bad stuff, and then that student turned round and then skipped whatever, you know, and almost felt as if throwing back the hard work into my face, I had to physically stop myself at that period of time from letting that tarnish the next one who came seeking help.
So you try not to withdraw as a defence,
and
so that you could still be supporting other people.
Yeah, and project onto the next person. I can't find the right words for it right now, but that frustration and that anger that this other one who, you know, clearly hadn't been gracious, I suppose, is the way to describe it.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, people that have, just because you're going through bad things doesn't make you a bad person. But sometimes when students going through things, they can be selfish about stuff.
Bad behavior might happen.
Students with bad behavior can go through bad things, and people with good student behavior can go through bad things.
Yeah.
And it's not to tarnish one with the other.
So again, it's you keeping each part of the student in mind separately, also. Not taking it personally. So there's a real parallel process there.
Yeah. So it's that thing about not taking it personally, because there was something in my head that, without me being a lecturer, was a case of, if that happened in a non-educational situation, then that would jade me.
Right. Because if it's over, it's more personal.
Yeah. But I'm a lecturer, so I can't let it jade me, because the next person along could be going through worse things than the person who jaded me.
So it's your job to contain and deal with what you're left with. It's not your job to spew it out all over the next person.
And no one taught me that. That was just through experience. And that little inkling, based on my own experiences, of not to tarnish the next person along, because the next person along is not the previous person.
So important. Do you know, that's so important. But you've also said something really interesting, which I thought would come up at some point here, which is, you're not trained to do that. So you and many, many other people in your field, you know, teachers in schools, whatever, consistently have to deal with, you know, fairly extreme stuff that students and pupils might be bringing to them. I don't know, child abuse, all kinds of stuff is brought to teachers, and they don't have, it's not part of your education in order to, like, know how to deal with it. And so, I mean, I can't, and maybe it is in some, I'm not, you know, I don't know, so I'm not saying nobody ever gets taught that, so then someone will come at me if I say that. But, you know, maybe it does sometimes. It's not a core part of your training, for sure. Yeah. So you've said something really important there, because you have deliberately learned from that, and you've had a self-awareness, and you've had a process, and that's how you've looked after yourself in it. But it's not an inbuilt process that you have. Like, in my profession, we have supervision. Like, we're one of the we're not one of the only professions that has it. We're one of the only mental health professions that has it. Like, lots of other mental health professionals don't have supervision. So they don't even have the opportunity to work through what you've just described. Mm-hmm. When, you know, a parallel thing, I guess, in my job might be, say you're working with a client and it's not working for them, and they say they don't want to work with you anymore. So it's a sort of similar, you know, that needs to be worked through, doesn't it? Because you could be left with all kinds of things if you don't. Yeah. And like you say, if it then affects your ability to work with the next person. So that is highly complex stuff that you've managed to evolve a way to deal with. But you're not trained to, I'm literally trained to do that. You're not trained to do that. or supported to do it either.
Yeah. Well, at the time, you know, talking about the support side, you know, there was no support for the staff. And it becomes an anecdote that you share with other, you know, staff members over a coffee. And you talk it through that way, but it's more, you know, effing a blind and, you know, about like...
Yeah, so letting it out. Yeah.
I'm not going to do that again, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But then you pick yourself up and then you do it again because the next person's not the previous person. So it's that venting aspect of amongst, you know, the staff room conversation.
Yeah. So the informal support system.
The informal support. Well, mostly somebody just listening to your vent. And rant, and then you walk out the door, and you're back to this role you're playing, because it is a role, and you're talking about how do you support yourself when you're going through it. It is that projected role. I learned this fairly early-ish that it's performance lecturing.
Absolutely.
And it's also that comes from, you know, the whole idea about, you know, fake it until you make it within the creative industries and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to a recent graduate just the other week about this, and he says, "I know I hate that phrase because, you know, he's like me from working class background in the creative industries, and that's got a whole different level of connections to how you make it." And he's like, "No." I said, "Well, I always added an extra thing to that." Okay. Is don't believe your own BS.
Do that, but hold on to some humility about it.
Yeah, because as soon as you start believing what you're faking, then you're on a slippery slide down.
Something else. Because that's not authentic. Okay, so there's something in here about authenticity, which is another concept that runs right through this podcast in every single way. Because this is literally an authentic conversation between two people all our conversations are between people who are passionate about what they do and lifelong learning and development, all of us. So that's kind of how this works. And it's like, if you have that authenticity in everything you do in your work, you will have a successful career.
It's funny you just said the A word, because that's something that has crept into my day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where I picked it up from, you know, the word authenticity and as a sort of like ethos to work around and to work towards on a day-to-day basis, just as a personal thing, not just as a lecturer or whatever. But it's certainly something that, at least in the last 3 years, I've been saying to the students more and more.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's probably been in floating around in my head for a longer time period than that. But I'm conscious of talking to them about being authentic. Probably because I've become course leader. And I feel, you know, that I've got more of a responsibility over everybody rather than just the group.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably why, in my head, the word authentic is something that I say more often to more students than previously. So I probably have been using it for a longer time than I think I've been using it.
Because it's so key to everything.
And I think that's the thing that, you know, as you said, you know, going back to when I first met you and Mark, that you said, I've always been like that. You know, me personally, I've always been like that. And I had to stop myself from thinking, I don't think up to that point I knew or had the courage to be authentic about myself. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you knew me in the early days when I was learning what I was authentic about.
Yeah, you were learning who you were and what you were going to be. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
I think I developed who I was authentically, quietly, without me having that A word.
Yeah. But now, is it that you've now landed in a... Because, you know, obviously I've known you for a very long time, and our conversations are different now to what they were then, because that's just normal. But, you know, like now, I don't know, is it more that you're using that word now because you're more identified? You know, you've landed in a place, you seem... correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem really, really comfortable with yourself. You seem very happy with where you are in life. You know, you think you're okay with the future. You know, you're okay with your age. There's a lot of stuff that you now kind of feel good about. Is
Yeah, I
that?
think there's certainly authentic, which is one A word. I think there's another A word underpinning all of this, which is acceptance.
Yes.
Not accepting your situation, because you can change situations, but accepting who I am.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, that you grow into who you are. But obviously, you know, different people have lots of different trials and tribulations to get there. But I think it's knowing who you are and how you live in the world. I've become existentialist in my old age, sorry.
No, this one's it's fantastic. Yeah, this
But I think
yeah.
it's that sense of situated being
Yeah.
in regards to, yeah, meaning and knowledge emerges. That's the way I frame things. That, you know, we create the world around us based upon our experiences. And I push that to the students in accessible ways.
Yeah, no, this is really
Not
good.
heavy philosophical ways, but, you know, it underpins everything that I do in a way. And, you know, so I suppose that is also a way for me personally to shield myself from some of these conversations you have, you know, on their issues. And yeah, as you say, some of it can be horrendously stuff that you have to escalate. And
Yeah,
others, it's just a
absolutely.
sort of like, you know, a quick little, you know,
Yeah.
pep talk chat.
Safeguarding level issues.
You know, so it's that thing that I think within the personal, I think I know that I have what my existence is. They're learning where they exist. And yeah, it'd be great to say that some of the negative, really negative stuff that they go through won't affect them negatively, but it's trying to flip that negative to the positive of, okay, you know, you're going through really bad stuff right now, but it won't always be this way. Because I always remember, as I said, I mentioned, I went through CBT, and the visualizer techniques, they said, you know, you're in a valley, you're in a dark valley, and you've got a short, you know, a very sharp climb, but when you get to the top, it's a plateau, and there'll be sunlight there, you know, and it's all these things. You're like, nah, I can't accept that. I can't accept I'm never going to get out of this valley. And then little steps, little steps, little steps, and before you know it, you're out the valley,
And
and
you
it is
can't
true.
believe you were ever
Yeah,
in the yeah.
but I remember that sense of I'm never going to get out of this, and telling the students who I'm having conversations with.
Yeah, so sharing a little bit about your own experience of that is really valuable.
That I can guarantee that, well, I can't guarantee, but as much as possible, that when we say this to them, and when other people say this to them, there is a truth behind it, that
And authenticity. So they'll
an
be able to hear
authenticity.
that, even if you're not spelling out your own, obviously you're not spelling out your own exact
So it's
thing.
the cool auntie and uncle thing again, you know, rather than the parents, that if they're going through counseling, the counselor is sort of like the parent role, telling them this stuff, or, you know, making them try and visualize this stuff, and they're like, nah, I'm not accepting this. But then somebody's been through it.
But they can tell, I mean, that actually resonates to me because when I'm working with clients, if I'm working with a client, so a lot of my clients have health issues, and some of them know that I have health issues and some of them don't. But there's some stuff that you work with, they know that you know it. Like that, like it's the same with you. There's an authenticity to it, even though you're not saying, well, in 1990, whatever this happened to me, you're not saying that, but you are saying something with a level of authenticity that is accepted and it's known on a deep human level. So that's a very similar thing, I think. Whereas
And
if
it's
you
a
were just spouting something you'd read in a book, they'd be like, yeah, whatever, just ignore
I
that.
think it's that trust thing, and I think
Yeah,
that's, you know,
it is.
creative industries thing again. It's that you have to trust. You have to trust the job's going to come in. You have to trust you're going to get paid for that
You have
job.
to keep going with the flow of the whole thing. And like you said, in your whole career, you have kept finding ways to move forward. You have Can I ask you something really important, which I'm aware that some of the listeners might need to know more about, and you might not have an answer, which is fine. But if somebody was in like maybe an early career stage, or they hadn't done all the work on themselves that you've done, and they're a teacher or a lecturer or whatever, and they were finding that students talking to them about difficult things was something that was really badly affecting them, what support systems are available, or what would you recommend that they do with that?
That's a very good question. And I think in my experience in the different institutions that I've moved to, the support for the students and the support in two different degrees for the staff is more in place than it had been in previous incarnations. That's not to say that it differs institution to institution, because it does. But I think it's that thing that I've worked in institutions where staff members are, let's just say, unempathic, not just to the students, but also to others,
Colleagues, yeah.
colleagues. And I'm always deeply suspicious of people like that, because I'm feeling they're bottling up stuff that they probably could do with their, working through. But yeah, I think it only takes you that fall into that type of regime where you've got more people like that than less people like that. So I think it's hard to be anything but general here, because obviously, if I be specific, somebody's going to say, well, it's not like that in my institution. But I think that it's that thing that the more we talk, and this sounds trite, but the more we talk about it, the more we can open up the conversations for mutual support of each other. And, because I say different institutions have different levels of support of the staff. Now, I've been in institutions where I've not been supported, and I've been in institutions where I felt supported. But what I have consciously done, that when I started working in my current employer, it was COVID. I moved from one institution to another institution during the very first 80 days of the lockdown. And so, I became course leader virtually, and I had a whole new team that I recruited. And I think we've all gelled together as a team, disparate people, but we'd all gelled together as a team, because I was mindful of not just the students going through crap, but the staff
So
also
that
going
was on the agenda. It was
through
named,
crap.
it was there.
And I think, from my perspective as course leader, that I've got responsibility to my staff as well. And I think if you are bottled up too much, you can have negative impacts on yourself
Oh,
and also other people
absolutely.
around you. But if you acknowledge the fact that other people can be going through same issues, different issues, but same sort of trials and tribulations, that if we mutually support each other through anything that happens, we're going to be in a better position individually and collectively.
Yeah, so it's coming full circle to where we started about modeling vulnerability and saying we need to talk about the difficult stuff. So if somebody was in an organization that wasn't supportive and that person wasn't very used to dealing with their own emotional stuff, like lots of universities and colleges have counseling services, don't
Absolutely.
they? So would would that be a place that a person could get that level of support, do you think?
I would seek that. I would, as somebody who, white heterosexual male grew up in the 1980s, where, if you're a white heterosexual male, you didn't talk about this stuff because, you're a man, and it's you talk about it. Do you know what I mean? Without getting too much into it, that my family background was Scots Presbyterian, Irish Catholic, and between those two structures, talking about this stuff was problematic growing up. that culturally, it was that reinforcement. Now, as all of those elements start to loosen in regard to you open up as a human, never mind what you believe in, but you open up as a human and acknowledge individually we have times when life isn't good.
And when we need to do something about that.
And we need to do something about this. And it doesn't matter what you've been taught on how you should be. It's a fundamental to be. And it's that being, you know, we need to be the best being we possibly can be for ourselves.
Because if it's not working, something needs to change. And I think that's the problem, isn't it, with lots of these kind of social and cultural ideas that we get given and we get taught and we get brought up by people who haven't had anything different given to them. Like, in a way, you know, people are breaking new ground here, aren't they, by doing something different and then passing it on, because that's what you're doing in your work. Mm-hmm. You're passing on your own learning and development and modeling it to young people. And even if it's from the person, like one of the people who heard that thing about imposter syndrome, right down to ones that you've done one-to-one deep mm-hmm. levels of support with, that will have had an impact. And so everybody wins from an individual doing this work, don't they, as well?
Exactly. I mean, I've seen it, you know, immediately, you know, very recently. I won't give specifics, mm-hmm. but very recently, you know, I was talking to somebody I've known for a long, 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 long time. And, you know, as you said, you didn't know about, you know, my mental health when you first met me. I didn't know about her mental health until, you know, we sort of, you know, broke bread again and caught up. And her and her talk, and then me basically saying, yes, I understand where you're coming from, because all of a sudden they felt completely vindicated is not the right word for it, but they felt, oh my God, I've been alone in this thought for so long. Mm-hmm. Now, this is me projecting on you know what she was feeling, but it felt as if that all of a sudden there was connections, real connections that had come back, that she'd separated herself because going through this, thinking no one.
It's just me. Mm-hmm.
And I've got to get on with it.
Yeah.
And similar background to, you know, to my background of, you know, you don't talk about this stuff.
Mm.
And she talked about it, you know, in her own right, you know, she helped, you know, counsel and things like that. But talking to somebody she'd known for a long, long time.
It's like talking a different language. It's really helpful.
All of a sudden it was like, I'm not alone. And I think it's that thing that you're not alone.
Yeah. And it's okay. It's okay it to show okay. those sides of yourself.
And, you know, just a quick little tip that when, you know, I mentioned earlier the fact that when I self-diagnosed myself as having depression, even though I didn't know what depression was, by looking at my reflection on a rainy bus window.
Yeah.
I went to the doctor then, which was like early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, the GP, was like almost like panicking about what do I do. And I went through different ways before I found the right fit for me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to go on antidepressants. That's what I knew I didn't want.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went through wrong turns. Now, when you're going through a depressive episode,
it's really hard to try things. Yeah.
But there was a resilience in me going, no, this isn't right. I need to go back. And that, in a way, has been my power cell. Because I did that for myself. No one did that for me.
Yeah,
I did that for myself, and I just started to believe in that little kernel of who
because
I was.
Because you always had the determination. Because within that, even though you were depressed at the time, to do that, there has to be a bit of hope, that determination that keeps you going forward.
Now, I didn't have that word at the time. It's only when you look back on it, you go, actually,
it must have been there. It must have been there. Otherwise, you wouldn't put the effort in. I mean, I think that's fantastic. Wow. There's so much in this conversation. It's just wonderful. I'm just aware we're running down on time a little bit. So coming towards the end, I just wanted to reflect a little bit more on the creativity stuff, because obviously you are literally a creative professional. That's where you've always been an artist. Your whole career is around creativity and teaching creativity. And I mentioned before, didn't I, that I was delighted to meet you and everybody else in that art studio. And over many, many years, I've realized that I am also an artist. And the reason, I mean, obviously, I love my friends who are artists, but the reason I hang around with so many artists is because I wanted to be one. And so now I am, now I do paint, and I do, and I think what we talk about quite a lot on the podcast, maybe in quite subtle ways, is, and I mentioned it before in terms of doing this podcast, the amount of creativity that is inherent in the work that I do, because you said seat of your pants earlier, didn't you, when you were talking about your career? And an interaction like this is seat of your pants, because we don't know what we're going to say. We haven't planned it. You're doing therapy, depends what type of therapy you're doing. Some therapies are quite manualized and structured, but the way I work is fairly open. So basically anything can happen, and it's very exciting. And I've realized over time how creative that actually is. And so I also this week was reflecting on all the other guests and my co-host have also got a creative practice outside of their work. So all these different professions, that we've had, social worker, podcast Paul is a careers development. In fact, he's a course leader as well. Mm-hmm. So he's like a similar career to you, which is quite interesting. And other counsellors and lecturers, they've all got artistic practices. So it's kind of making me realise a lot more about how interconnected working with people and creativity actually is. And maybe getting to a good place in your career also involves you getting to a place where you can fully express yourself authentically in your personal time. So I don't know what you think about that, but I felt like I wanted to say it because it's kind of important to our relationship here, isn't it, as well?
Absolutely. I think I've grown into the realization that as humans, we are creative. Mm. We wouldn't be where we are without being creative. Mm-hmm. Now, some of us are more creative than others in what we call creativity. I'm in the creative industries. My brother he's retired, but he was an analytical chemist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In his role, there's creativity within that. Analytical, but there is elements of creative thinking of, what if we now do this, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've always had a problem with people saying I'm not creative, I can't draw. What you're saying is you're not Michelangelo, none of us are.
Yeah.
But you can write your name, can't you? Yes. Well, you put marks down. Yes. Well, those marks.
Yeah. It's an expression.
It's an expression of what you're thinking, because you're putting marks down. Now, you mentioned before, I'm a researcher. I'm really into semiotics, the study of signs.
At your YouTube videos earlier. Yeah. Thank you for the plug. People. There'll be a link to the show notes.
But where I've gone with that is trying to explain semiotics to creative people, from heavy theory to practice. I've realized I can't talk about semiotics and the theory of semiotics without talking about people.
Okay. Yeah.
And it comes back to what I just mentioned there about the fact that we are a symbolic mammal. We put marks down to mean something else.
Yeah, it's how we make meaning in the world.
And meaning is intrinsically there.
Yeah.
And I think that sense of creativity is within us. And I've always had a pet sort of theory since I was obviously, in the creative industries and as oppressive from when I was studying the first time around, when I was doing H&D, I realized it'd gone further back than I thought. Mm-hmm. And I was depressed for a longer period than I could put words to. And I've always had this pet thought that the very nature of maybe some of us are more prevalent to depression in the creative industries is because of, the world, just before the break, we were talking about the outsider, is we see the world slightly differently.
Yeah.
And one of the things when I was doing going through CBT that I really enjoyed and really found a way of expressing what was in my head, trying to get that out, was through the aspects of, we had different workshops throughout each of the sessions. And when we got onto the art therapy side, put it down into, an image.
Yeah.
I could do that. I was trying to get work as an illustrator, and I basically just used as an extension of my creative practice.
Yeah.
And it was at that point in the CBT that I realized that I could make the connection between trying to visualize what I'm feeling through an image.
Yeah.
That then that kicked me into where I'm currently am now with my research is semiotics.
Wow. Oh, I love that. That's a real that's a really lovely full circle thing to draw together. So has anything arisen for a brief ending exercise for the audience to reflect on, do you think? Something simple.
I think the exercise that I would get people to do, your listeners to do, especially, you know, if they're in my field,
education.
Going through similar things with students that maybe they feel they're not that they feel they're not prepared for themselves. You know, it's triggering things in themselves, thinking like, well, you know, I'm not comfortable within this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is to first of all talk more with each other in a staff room environment about the specifics of how they're feeling about talking about these things. They don't talk to each other about what they're going through.
So naming the feelings, that it's happening.
Naming the feelings, because I can guarantee that others will identify with exactly the same things. And it may start a chain reaction of those people that are maybe not... maybe more negative about this stuff may start a thought in their heads that eventually they go and actually sort something out.
Again, modeling, good practice. Yeah.
And I think it's that domino effect. The more, you know, I made a reference early on. I'm not sure if it's on the recording or not, but it's in Spartacus about, like, you know.
Oh, yeah, you did.
You know, and all it takes is one person to stand up and go, I am. And then
everybody
goes, I am.
Stands up.
And then you realize, you look around and you realize, oh my God, this is a human thing.
And you achieve that by being authentic about your feelings. So there's so much overlocking interconnectedness about this conversation, but most of it is about communication and connectedness with other humans in all these different forms, which leads to better mental health, well-being, support, and overall quality of life. So it's that's fantastic,
and it ties into the creative industries. You know, obviously that's where we're talking about today.
Yeah,
the creative industries is you're reaching out to try and impact in somebody else's life. And within my area, I'll leave you on this one, but in my area of visual communication, there's a South American professor, Jorge Frescara, can't remember if he's Central American or South American. And I use him a lot to the students, and it lifts the students creatively up when they hear this, design students.
Yeah.
And saying, he basically says that actual visual communication design, graphic design, illustration isn't about the end result that people think it's about, you know, the visual side of things. It's actually being a facilitator for behavioral change.
Mm.
If you think about it, any piece of design work, whether it's an illustration, in a book or whatever, it doesn't have to be in a book, but anything, you're changed by that. Even if it's only a slight small thing, it's a page turn, or you go and buy something, you go and change your mind, and you do something or whatever.
And that's coming from the individual who's designed it. Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dave. This has been a wonderful, much even better than I imagined conversation. Thank you so much for being on here. So listeners, check out the show notes for more information about Dave and related episodes. We have a couple of episodes that are really strongly related to this topic. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Been a pleasure, Elizabeth.
Thank you for listening. We hoped you enjoyed this episode.
How We Care is brought to you by Elizabeth Turk and Paul Gaunt via Simplecast.
Case studies are generalised and do not relate to individual clients.
Please subscribe for more episodes, rate us and follow us on Twitter, details in the show notes, for information on upcoming episodes.
Many thanks to Ed Tidy for the music and technical assistance.
See you next time. We'll be right back.